This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Iran says that it has, in fact, broken a stockpile limit set by the 2015 nuclear accord. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The state-run IRNA news agency quoted Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif as making the stockpile announcement. The deal had limited Iran to 300 kilograms of uranium enriched to 3.67%. This represents the first time Iran has broken one of the limits set by the 2015 pact with world powers. The announcement comes as tensions remain high between Iran and the US. In recent weeks, the wider Persian Gulf has seen Iran shoot down a US military surveillance drone, mysterious attacks on oil tankers, and Iranian rebels in Yemen launched drones into Saudi Arabia. I'm Charles Ledesma.
UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric says that the Secretary General is urging Tehran to uphold the terms of the 2015 nuclear agreement titled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
He encourages the Islamic Republic of Iran to continue implementing all its nuclear-related commitments under the JCPOA as the participants continue to seek ways to overcome the considerable challenges the country faces.
And asked if he had any message for Iran, President Trump.
No message to Iran. They know what they're doing. They know what they're playing with. And I think they're playing with fire.
Reports from Sudan say at least 11 people were killed in the latest mass protest demanding a transition to civilian rule in that country. Police fired tear gas as tens of thousands of people took to the streets on Sunday in the capital, Khartoum, and other areas in the first such demonstration since a June deadly crackdown on protesters. More demonstrations were reported Monday. In Washington, the United States condemned the violence used against civilians. This is VOA News. A group of five heavily armed men Monday carried out a powerful vehicle bomb and gun attack in the Afghan capital of Kabul, killing at least one person and wounding dozens of others. Officials said the ensuing clashes lasted about 9 hours before Afghan security forces killed all the assailants. The Taliban quickly claimed responsibility for plotting the suicide raid, which came as the Taliban and the United States are engaged in a fresh round of talks in Qatar aimed at finding a political settlement to the war in Afghanistan. The United Nations said it was appalled by the attack claimed by the Taliban. Congressional Democrats have toured Texas border facilities as news has emerged about a secret Facebook group for Border Patrol agents that includes racist and sexually violent content. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Members of Congress visit an immigration detention center and two Border Patrol stations in the El Paso area. Texas Democrat Congressman Joaquin Castro says immigration and Border Patrol have a long way to go in improving conditions.
The system is still broken and that people's human rights are still being abused.
ProPublica reports a closed Facebook page made up of current and former Border Patrol members included sexist posts and comments mocking migrant deaths.
There are many within CBP who become desensitized to the point of being dangerous to the migrants in their care.
Border Patrol head Carla Provost says any employee violating standards will be held accountable. I'm Tim McGuire.
Facebook evacuated a mail facility near its Silicon Valley company headquarters Monday after a package tested positive for the nerve agent sarin. The company said two people were being evaluated for possible exposure to the toxic compound. It said two have not shown any symptoms of exposure, but they're being tested because they came into contact with the suspicious package. Authorities ordered the mail facility, which included four buildings in a park, under quarantine and conducted tests on the area. They later cleared three buildings and allowed employees working there to return. Facebook spokesman Anthony Harrison said authorities have not yet identified the exact substance found in a suspicious package and said the company is cooperating with police. The sudden summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un arose out of their common desire for perpetuating the illusion of denuclearization. That's according to some experts. This is even though their divergent definitions of denuclearization remain unchanged. North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency on Monday hailed Sunday's summit at the inter-Korean border village and reported the next step would be denuclearization talks with Washington. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's main opposition leader explains why he was allegedly kidnapped.
The abductors said that they want me to pull my parliamentarians out of parliament, senators out of senate, and mayors out of councils because I was the one blocking their independence.
Nijon Frundi is the leader of the opposition Social Democratic Front Party. Kenya offers land for a South Sudan dry port. A member of former Gambian President Yahya Jammeh's ruling council was charged Monday with murder. And civil society groups sue Uganda and Rwanda over the continued closure of the two countries' border.
The suit against the two governments is aimed at ensuring that the losses incurred by the business community, the farmers, and the citizens are audited and the concerned parties are adequately compensated.
Sheila Kawamara is the executive director of the East African Sub-Regional Support Initiative for the Advancement of Women. And Shoe Priest reveal what they learned during confession. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party has rejected President Paul Biya's offer of security escort. John Frundi says he does not need security escort to walk among his people in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. The opposition leader was abducted from his home in Bamenda on Friday, hours after his return from a four-day medical treatment for an undisclosed ailment. Frundi was released Saturday after the kidnappers demanded he pull members of his party from parliament. But Frundi said he told his alleged kidnappers that he needed to first consult with officials of his party before responding to their demands.
The abductors said that they want me to pull my parliamentarians out of parliament, senators out of senate, and mayors out of councils because I was the one blocking their independence. I asked them how. I said it was not only SDF parliamentarians and mayors and senators from the north and southwest that were in parliament, but they also CPDM, and most of CPDM people have more in that institution than the SDF. What was their quarrel with the SDF? They said the SDF is the main opposition that they know, and if that SDF gets out of way, they'll be able to know what to do. I said, okay. And they said, they were giving me 24 hours to declare. I told them that I cannot declare in 24 hours because I'm a Democrat and I need to consult my mayors, parliamentarians, and senators for us to know what to do.
After you told them, what happened next? Did they threaten you that they would kidnap you again if you don't abide by their demands or you don't meet their demands?
If they are honest enough to publish the pictures that they made themselves, they encircled me with their guns and interviewed me, and I talked it out in their presence. That, well, if I consult with my parliamentarian senators, etc., I was going to come back to them. And they said it was okay.
Moments ago, you were meeting the governor and other delegations. Did the government make any promise of providing additional security to prevent such incidents from occurring again, since this was the second time of some groups kidnapping you?
Yes, Peter, I'll be very frank and honest to tell the world that the Cameroon government has done everything to give me the protection, to be escorting me wherever I want to go. But you see, I cannot be moving in my own hometown, in my own village, in my own bedroom with escorts, which means that it's become so bad that I need escort to move here and there. There are the bad people who are trying to destroy the cause. They are the good people. And I think that the good and the bad and whatever, I think I can move with them. So when they do what they are doing, we do what we are doing.
So when are you going to meet your lawmakers, parliamentarians, and the senators to address some of these threats and demands made by your abductors?
I am not in a hurry because when I was abducted, I told them. I just came in. I was not in the house for 2 hours when I returned from hospital in Bingo. I've been in Bingo for about 4 days. I was still not stable, not balanced. And that's why they grabbed me and dragged me as if they were dragging a pig local village market. And with all this stress, I have to be a little relief because we can sit down and talk meaningfully.
John Frundi is leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Bamenda. A spokesman for Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonian Republic says the group did not kidnap the leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF Party. Chris Anu says SDF leader John Frundi might have been abducted by a group sponsored by Cameroon's Minister for Territorial Administration, Paul Atanga Nji, to blame it on what he calls Amazonian Restoration Forces. Frundi told VOA his abductors demanded he withdraws his party representatives from parliament and stop blocking the drive for the independence of Anglophone Cameroon. But separatist spokesman Chris Anu says the Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanga Nji ordered Frundi's abduction to give the separatists a bad name.
The problem is that any group can go out there and purportedly speak on behalf of Ambazonia. What we know is that the people who picked up or abducted Chairman John Frundi were not members of Ambazonia Restoration Forces. We are very sure that the group that is being sponsored by the French Cameroon minister called Paul Atanga Nji sponsored a kid. Paul Atanga Nji would be the only one who can come up with a clever tactic to be used in picking up John Frundi.
Are you talking about the Interior Minister?
Correct, the Territorial Administration Minister.
So what incentive would he have to order the abduction of John Frundi?
He doesn't have to have any incentive because he is a political hack who sees the presence of Frundi in the scene as a threat to his own political career. To give Ambazonians a bad name.
So you are saying your group has nothing to do with the alleged abduction of Mr. Frundi?
No, absolutely not. When Mr. Frundi was picked up, I actually called him twice. Unfortunately, he didn't leave with his phone, but his aides picked up the phones, and we were trying to find out if they had information as to who picked him up. And twice they said they did not know. We put out press statement indicating that our restoration forces did not pick him up. Now, we have to understand that our restoration forces have hierarchy. When things like this happen, it is reported to hierarchy, and we would know who did it. In this case, nothing was reported to us. And if you ask Chairman John Frundi, I think he will tell you our restoration forces did not pick him. There is a phenomenon on the ground of what they call Amber Boys. Amber Boys are owned by this same guy, Paul Atanga Nji, and they will do anything to blackmail Ambazonian people who are fighting for their independence. Again, if Mr. Frundi says Ambazonia Restoration Forces, if he can testify that they picked him, then we will investigate. But if he says Amber Boys picked him, I can assure you, Amber Boys belong to Paul Atanga Nji.
Chris, thank you. It's always nice to talk with you.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Chris Anu, Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. You're speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Three civil society groups in Uganda have filed a lawsuit against the governments of Rwanda and Uganda in the East African Court of Justice over the continued closure of the border between the two countries. The closure, now in its fourth month, has recorded financial losses, not only for the two governments, but also for local business people. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
On February 27th, the government of Rwanda closed the border posts of Gatuna Katuna in Kabale District and Chanika in Kisoro District. 4 months later, the border posts are still closed. Three regional civil society organizations, including the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, say they filed a suit on June 21st. The lawsuit asks the court to issue a permanent injunction against the governments of Rwanda and Uganda to keep them from closing the border posts between the countries and ensure the free movement of people and trade. Sheila Kawamara is the executive director of the East African Sub-Regional Support Initiative for the Advancement of Women.
The suit against the two governments is aimed at ensuring that the losses incurred by the business community, the farmers, and the citizens and society at large are audited and the concerned parties are adequately compensated.
Hassan Nsimiraho has been doing cross-border business for 10 years, dealing in beans, peas, and cassava flour exported to Rwanda. He says alternative routes offered by Rwanda were also affected by the border closure, such as areas in the Kavale district affiliated to Gatuna-Katuna border post. Hassan says they have been denied permission to collect their goods imported into Rwanda.
For the Gwandese side, they were allowed to take their goods back home. But to our side, even when you go to Gwandan Revenue Customs, you can find some bags of beans. They were denied us to take back to our country. So if the government can do something about it, I think they should compensate us.
In June, Rwanda reopened the border and allowed trucks in for just 12 days. The Ministry of Trade and Industries says since the closure in February, Uganda exports to Rwanda are down from $660 million to about $203 million. Rwanda also reports a loss of about $104 million. Amelia Chambade, Uganda's Minister for Trade and Industry, says the government has not responded to the lawsuit as officials discuss what she describes as a complicated matter.
But I'd advise Ugandans also to look for other routes. I know I was advocating for DRC at one point, but now there's now the challenge of Ebola. But Rwanda, there are still talks from the top level. Let us leave it to our principals. Why would we negotiate also with our colleagues, the ministers?
Gatuna-Katuna border post has historically been the major crossing point for cargo trucks and cross-border trade, both formal and informal, heading to Rwanda, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Currently, trucks allowed into Rwanda are only those for transit goods to Burundi and the DRC. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Tuesday, the second day of July. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Kenya has given South Sudan a piece of land for a South Sudan dry port. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said the dry port at Naivasha and Lamu will strengthen trade between the two countries. Maureen Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The two countries have agreed to set up a joint border commission for the management of their common border. Speaking yesterday, Monday, at State House in Nairobi, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta announced that Kenya will hold a trade expo in Juba, November this year. Mr. Kenyatta said Kenya's donation to a dry port for Sudan in Naivasha and Lamu port is a way of showing confidence in Sudan's economy.
The expo, we believe, will reignite our trade and commerce cooperation and send a very powerful signal that indeed South Sudan is open for business. There exists a huge trade potential between our two countries, and we have discussed and identified strategies to be employed to enhance our bilateral trade. To ease the movement of goods consigned to South Sudan, the Kenya government has responded to the request of South Sudan to set aside 10 acres of land at the inland container depot in Naivasha Industrial Park for use as a dry port by the government of South Sudan.
The two heads of state have initiated efforts to amicably resolve disputes that may arise from the shared border arrangement. President Kenyatta called on the international community to intervene and help bring peace in South Sudan.
Building a deeper and sustainable peace in South Sudan, I wish to reaffirm once again my personal commitment and that of my government to ensuring that the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan is fully implemented. In this regard, I urge the international community, led by the United Nations and the Troika of the United States, United Kingdom and Italy, to engage strongly in support of the people of the South Sudan as well as her government.
On the other hand, the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir said Kenya and South Sudan shall exchange views on issues of mutual interest. Mr. Kiir says Kenya has been at the forefront of ensuring that peace prevail in South Sudan.
President Uhuru Kenyatta and I have had very fruitful discussions on a broad range of issues spanning from political, economic and security matters of mutual interest. It is also gratifying to know that we have now agreed on a framework for the engagement on border issues, and technical teams from both countries will soon meet to start the process of resolving border-related issues.
The shared border deal comes at a time when Kenya is having border wrangles with its neighbor Somalia over resources. President Kenyatta and Kiir signed several memorandums, including the minutes of the inauguration session of the Kenya-South Sudan Joint Commission of Cooperation. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Gambia has charged Yankuba Toure, a member of former President Yahya Jammeh's ruling council, with murder. Toure appeared in court on Monday on allegations he took part in the killing of former Gambian finance minister Ousmane Koro Cisse. Pandere Mbai reports.
Supporters of the former ruling APRC party converged at the High Court in Banjul on Monday to show solidarity with the former junta local government minister Yankuba Toure. Toure has been charged for the murder of Gambia's former finance minister Ousmane Koro Cisse. The prosecution says it was back in June of 1995 at Kololi in the west coast region of the Gambia when former army captain Yankuba Toure acted with malice to allegedly cause the death of Cisse. The prosecution also says Cisse was assaulted with dangerous weapons, which led to his death. Retired Army Captain Ibu Jalo was the former junta spokesperson when Ousmane Koro Cisse was allegedly murdered. Jalo had to resign from his post to resettle in the United States.
Being a member of the council and spokesman of the council, I did my preliminary investigation on this matter. And what I found out is that actually the people that really killed Koro Cisse was Captain Edward Singate, Captain Peter Singate, his brother, Alhaji Kanji, who was a staff sergeant then, and another sergeant called Tamba. These are the people that I know for a fact committed the act of murder on Koro Cisse.
Toure appeared before the High Court under heavy security protection. He has been languishing in jail since last week. This followed Toure's refusal to testify before the TRRC. Toure has invoked constitutional immunity to justify his refusal to give evidence. He claimed that he had been indemnified by the 1997 constitution. The former finance minister was said to have been allegedly murdered at the home of Yankuba Toure. He was lured into the property after seeing off dictator Jammeh to the airport. Captain Ibu Jalo again.
Now, with respect to Yankuba Toure, I learned from Edward Singate himself and Yankuba himself, they both told me that Yankuba had no idea of what they were going to do in his house. He was made to believe that they were going to have a meeting at his house only for things to turn out south. And when they started the shooting, actually, it was the shooting that Edward Singate, the two shots that he fired at Koro Cisse, that's what startled Yankuba, and he was trying to run out and bolt out of the house.
Jalo was on an official trip to Libya when the late Libyan dictator Muhammad Gaddafi broke the news of Cisse's death to him. Dictator Jammeh also had informed him about Koro's demise.
I was told by former President Yahya Jammeh. He told me in a plane en route from when we were flying. He was coming from Addis Ababa, and I was flying out from Tripoli, Libya. So I joined his flight at Zurich in Switzerland, and en route, when we were airborne, that's when he told me that Singate orchestrated the murder of Koro Cisse. And then he was like, when we go down, I will give you the details of what happened. And he was really worried. I can see from his face.
One of the TRRC witnesses, Alhaji Kanye, has confessed to taking part in the murder of Ousmane Koro Cisse. Kanye also says Yankuba Toure was among those who had participated in the murder of Ousmane Koro Cisse. A Justice Ministry official told VOA that Toure is going to appear in court today, Tuesday, on contempt charges. The official says Toure had treated the TRRC with disrespect and utter contempt. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
In spite of public pressure from priests to reveal information they learned in the confessional, the Vatican's highest court has issued a document approved by Pope Francis that explains why priests should not disclose such details. The document says that although not always understood by modern world, the seal of the confessional is unbreakable, indispensable, and necessary for the penitent's freedom of conscience. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
A 6-page document signed by the head of the Vatican's Apostolic Penitentiary, a tribunal which deals with absolution and confessional matters, and approved by Pope Francis in June, reaffirms the inviolability of the confidentiality of confession. The clergy is obliged to maintain the secrecy of the confessional because it effectively transcends any and all human laws. A priest, the document says, is a conduit for the penitent to speak directly to God. The document further states every political or legislative initiative aimed at forcing the inviolability of the sacramental seal would constitute an unacceptable offense against the freedom of the Church, which doesn't receive its very legitimization from any single country but from God. This new document clarifies the position for priests who may hear something that they may feel needs to be reported to the police. The Vatican effectively exonerates them from repeating to anyone what they heard during confession. Since the sexual abuse scandals erupted, 7 U.S. states have passed laws requiring priests to report confessions of sexual abuse of minors, with more likely to do so. The statement issued by Cardinal Mauro Piacenza and published Monday, even though it only affirms existing church teachings, sets church and state firmly on a collision course. In Australia as well, 2 of the country's 8 states have introduced laws making it a crime for priests to withhold information about abuse heard in confession. Cardinal Piacenza, however, did clarify in a written comment on the document that there has been no change to Pope Francis's resolve to combat clerical abuse and cover-up. He wrote, "It's opportune to make clear that the text of the statement cannot and doesn't want to be in any way a justification or a form of tolerance of the abhorrent cases of abuse perpetrated by members of the clergy." He added that no compromise is acceptable in promoting the protection of minors and of vulnerable persons, and in preventing and combating every form of abuse in the spirit of that which has been constantly reiterated. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, the leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party has rejected President Paul Biya's offer for security escort. John Frundi says he does not need a security escort to walk among his people in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. The opposition leader was abducted from his home in Bamenda on Friday, hours after his return from a 4-day medical treatment for an undisclosed ailment. Frundi was released Saturday after the kidnappers demanded he pull members of his party from parliament. But Frundi said he told his alleged kidnappers that he needed to first consult with officials of his party before responding to their demands. A spokesman for Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonian Republic says the group did not kidnap the leader of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF party. Chris Anu says SDF leader John Frundi might have been abducted by a group sponsored by Cameroon's Minister for Territorial Administration, Paul Atanga Nji, to blame it on what he calls Ambazonian Restoration Forces. Anu says the Territorial Administration, Minister Paul Atanga Nji, ordered Frundi's abduction to give the separatists a bad name. And that is it for this Tuesday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee
you. And your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Thank you.